Education class is going to be on criminal procedure generally and walking through the lawyer steps in a felony case specifically. My name's Craig Rose. I'm an attorney in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. I've pretty much spent my whole career doing criminal defense work, and I get calls and questions all the time about what do I do if I get a felony case in a criminal matter? And a lot of times they end up just calling me and asking me what to do, so I figured, hey, why don't I let people know what to do? And the big thing is to walk everybody through the felony criminal procedure steps. And basically, the discussion is going to range from the arrest of the defendant through the trial phase. I'll talk a little bit about the appellate phase at the end, but I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on the plea, trial, and appellate phase, only because it's such detailed information and there's really not a lot of I won't have enough time to go through all that. I'll just give a general overview of that, but I do want to spend a lot of time on the steps that a lawyer has to go through when they get a call from a client that's been arrested. So from arrest to the end of the case, which would be either a plea, trial, or the case is dropped, we're going to spend a lot of time on. Now, I will start off with the initial call after a client's been, or a potential client's been arrested. And the first two phases in criminal procedure are going to be the preliminary hearing to detain, which is the initial appearance and bond setting, and the preliminary hearing to prosecute. Now, I call these the Wild West of the arrest phases of the criminal case. And the reason I say that is because, unlike most areas of law, this is an area that happens quickly. And if an attorney gets a call and the client still is sitting in jail or just got arrested, they have to know what to do, and they have to know what to do quickly. As most people know, the practice law, most things take time. Most things move slowly. This is not that. This is going to happen quickly. And you can really make a difference for your client if you know what to do quickly. The other reason that I wanted to get into it with the first two phases is because there's really not a lot of practice experience you need to do either preliminary hearing. You can pretty much just show up and do them. And I don't mean that flippantly. What I mean is there's not a lot of rules when it comes to the preliminary hearing. So if you do get retained and you're interested in doing it, then by all means, you will have a chance to make a difference for your client quickly by showing up and just and representing them the best you can. So the first thing is you get a call from a client or you get a call from a client's family and they say, we have someone that's been charged with a felony. What do I do? And, you know, one of the things is that I've learned is whenever you have a client call you, they're looking for help. And a lot of people that take those calls don't realize that they're really in a tight spot. So as a criminal defense attorney, and that's probably really true with us because liberty's at stake more than anything else, and you want to help them as quickly as possible. So you ask yourself a question, where do I begin and what do I do? Best question to ask. The first question I always ask is, what's the charge? That's an important question to ask. So if the client calls you, they're probably just bonded out or they are still sitting in jail. Or the family calls you and they say, you know, my loved one's in jail or my loved one's got a charge. You know, can you help us? So the first thing I ask is, you know, what's the charge? Well, that's an important question to ask because as we'll go through it, all charges, all felonies are not the same. The main question to ask on the charge is, what's the bond. If the bond's been set already, you'll kind of have an idea of what the charge is going to be. So a lower bond is going to be more of a nonviolent charge, a higher bond is going to be more of a violent charge, and you can go from there. A lot of times, the family member's not going to know exactly what was the charge. So that's the first question you ask, is what is the charge? The other questions you ask are, and you have to find out if it's a federal or state charge. Now, for purposes of this lecture, I'm going to be covering mostly state charges. The reason for that is because most charges are state-related. If you ask any federal prosecutor or any federal public defender, or if you ask any state prosecutor or any state public defender, the differences in dockets are unbelievable. For whatever reason, well, I know the main reason is because there's just more law enforcement activity at the state level on the street, right, than the federal level. So you're going to have more cases. So that's the big difference between federal and state, that and the law. So you have to find out whether the charge is federal or state. One thing I would say about the federal charge is the good thing is if it is a federal charge, you know that the law is going to be uniform in all 50 states. If it's a state charge, it's not, right? I mean, depending on what state you're in, that law in that state is going to be different than, say, another state. So those are two questions you have to ask. What's the charge? What's the jurisdiction? Most of the time, you're going to be getting calls from a state. You're going to be getting calls that are state-related. It's not going to be a most of the time, it's not going to be a federal charge. But if it is a federal charge, again, you have the federal law that you'll go by, and you will pursue it that way. Now, most arrests that happen on federal charges are usually done through a warrant, okay? And a lot of times, they will be held, the defendant will be held at a local jail near wherever the federal building is. So, for instance, I practice in Asheville, Mississippi. If someone's arrested on a federal charge, they'll be held at the Forest County Jail, which is our county in Hattiesburg, and they'll be walked across the street to the federal court for their initial appearance or their preliminary hearing or whatever. That's not always the case because there's not always a federal court in the same town or city that you practice in, but there's a it's going to be close to that area. So whatever the nearest federal courthouse is going to be located at, most likely that person will be detained in that jail in that area, in that county. So if you have someone in a federal jail, say in Gulfport, Mississippi, they're going to be in a local holding cell close to Gulfport. You just have to find out where and then go visit them there. But that's going to be the big thing. On the federal case, again, uniform law and the federal system is a little bit cleaner as far as procedure goes. And I don't mean that's disparaging to the state, but they just don't have as many cases. So when the federal court says, these are the dates, those are the dates. Now, in state court, you're going to get that too. You're going to get certain dates you have to be there. The only difference is there seems to be a lot more continuation of cases and hearings in state court as opposed to federal court. So in sum, I would say you need to find out if it's going to be in federal court or state court. If it is in federal court, understand that the docket's going to be moved a lot quicker. And whatever dates are set, they are set, and you've got to get in there those dates. Your client's probably been arrested on a warrant, so they need to you need to get that warrant. You need to find out what they're arrested for. You need to find out the nature of the charge. Go from there. What you would do in federal court, too, is you would contact the court administrator for the judge and just get a date that it's going to be the initial hearing. Once you get that, and that's all online, ECF, but once you get that, you'll know the time you have to be in court, and then you just go from there, okay? That's for federal. For state, it's similar, but it's different, if that makes sense. If it's a state charge, what's going to happen, and like I said, usually they are going to be state charges just because there's just more, there's more cases in the state. You don't have federal law enforcement agents walking in your local community arresting people. It just doesn't work that way. It's local law enforcement, and they are, it's going to be local police, it's going to be county police. So when they arrest someone, it's going to fall under the jurisdiction of the state of that circuit, okay? So in the state charge, it's the same deal. They'll get arrested, and they will have a, and they will go in front of the judge at some point for an initial appearance and a bond. So that's the first question you have to ask yourself, or I'm sorry, the first two questions you have to ask yourself. What's the charge? What's the jurisdiction? So for just to, for a hypothetical here, because I'm trying to intertwine practical practice with criminal procedure, let's say you get a call from a defendant's family, and they have a loved one that's been arrested for, let's say, grand larceny, and it's a state charge. Okay, where do we go from there? The first question you have to understand is the process, and that's where the procedure is, okay? So, so-and-so gets arrested for grand larceny. What happens next? Well, they're booked, and then they're put in jail. Okay, then the first thing that's coming up is going to be their preliminary hearing to detain, okay? The preliminary hearing to detain. Now, there is no right to counsel on a preliminary hearing to detain. So if someone was indigent, say, and they needed an attorney, a public defender, most of the time public defenders are not at those hearings because there's no right to counsel. The preliminary hearing to detain is basically to bring the, it's also called initial appearance, depending on your jurisdiction, but it's the client, the potential client or defendant in this matter, goes in front of the judge, and the judge reads the charges and then sets a bond. Now, that's supposed to happen within 48 hours of the arrest, okay? My experience has been that courts are really good about that. Even in jurisdictions that have maybe a reputation for being tough, courts are very good at like making sure that client gets in front of the judge and gets the charges read and the bond set. Now, if you've got the case and the defendant's been in jail for a week and they haven't had that, then you know, there's going to be problems, but that usually isn't the case. Usually within 48 hours, the defendant will be in front of the judge, get a bond set, and go for the, in a lot of states, including mine, what we do here in Mississippi is if a client's arrested, say, on a Friday or a Saturday, they're doing phone initials, which is setting the bond and or video and reading the charges and getting the bond set, so there's no lapse time. If someone's arrested on Friday, they used to go in front of the judge on Monday. Now with modern technology, a lot of times we're just getting the courts are getting them in front of judges and getting bond sets quickly. So that's a good thing. And like I said, that's going to be the first thing the defendant goes through after the arrest. They're going to have a time in jail, and then they're going to be read the charges, and then bond's going to be set. Once bond's set, what's the next step? Now, as an attorney, you can't really affect the initial appearance. As an attorney, you can't really affect the initial bond because you're not there, usually. If you were retained and before the initial appearance and before the bond, then you could go in front of the judge and talk to the judge about the bond setting. But the main thing is you're not going to have much of a impact on that. In fact, when you get the call to defend someone on a felony, usually that's already happened. The initial appearance has already happened. The bond's been set. They've already been in front of the judge. So you're just kind of picking off where that starts. The next question is, usually the defendant wants to know, how do I get out of here, right? I mean, it's not difficult. I mean, why I call it the Wild West arrest phase is because at that time, things happen quickly, and the defendant is concerned about their incarceration. They're wanting to bond out as quickly as possible. Sometimes it's easy. Sometimes it's not. We're going to get into that. So for argument's sake, and just using an example, let's say that that same defendant we were talking about that called you, or his family called you, they have a grand larceny charge. Judge brings them in front, initial appearance within 48 hours, initial appearance, preliminary hearing to detain. Judge reads the charges, so-and-so, grand larceny, sets the bond at, say, $15,000, okay, to give an example. So if the client has no holds, and I'll discuss those in a minute, no holds, the client can bond out right away. And the client or the client's family would call a bonding company, and usually most county jails have some sort of deal where, you know, they have a certain amount of bonding companies that they'll let bond out. It's usually the sheriff's discretion, and they will and there's always a list in the local jail that inmates can call, and then the families can call. It's usually, nowadays, you see advertisements when you walk in under the ATM machines. They got ATM machines in county jails now, and bondsmen have advertisements. And so it's not hard to find a bondsman, and they do work 24/7. That's where they usually are at late night, is at the jail. So say the client's got a $15,000 bond on grand larceny, calls a bondsman, bonds out, fine, he's done. Okay, he's done for now. And we'll get into his responsibilities out while he's out on bond. But how does that affect you? It doesn't really affect you as the attorney because your client's out on bond. You will pick up the case now, or you'll have the case, but the case really gets going once the client is indicted. If they're indicted, okay. But I'm assuming, for argument's sake, let's say that the client did not bond out, okay. So there's a $15,000 bond and a grand larceny charge, and they haven't bonded out. What's the next step? Okay, so the next step is, after the preliminary hearing to detain, bond setting, the next step would be the preliminary hearing to prosecute. Okay. Now, there is a right to counsel for the defendant to have an attorney for that. So even if the client couldn't afford an attorney, there is a right to counsel for that client to have an attorney present for the preliminary hearing to prosecute. And basically what that is that's the hearing where the client has a chance to argue to the judge that they shouldn't be held, that they should be allowed to go, even though it's to prosecute. If the judge finds probable cause, he's going to refer to the grand jury, basically, which means law enforcement's going to take it to the DA's office, and they're going to, you know, they can take it to grand jury if they want. But you're trying to, the probable cause standard, you're having the hearing to determine whether or not it's going to grand jury. That's the definition. You know, in the real world, I'm not sure that that's exactly accurate. I think that second hearing is a little bit more of a hearing to detain, because the local municipal judge or the local county judge or the local city prosecutor or local county prosecutor, they have absolutely no impact on whether or not a case gets indicted or not, which is prosecute for a felony, right? So basically, in my opinion, it's a hearing to see whether or not the defendant's going to stay in jail or not, because they're going to send everything over to the DA's office at some point, and they're going to make the decision whether or not to prosecute. But for purposes of the proper nomenclature, it is the preliminary hearing to prosecute. That's usually done pretty quickly. So your scenario is, you have a client in jail, grand larceny charge, $15,000 bond, and the client wants to bond out but doesn't wants a lower bond. How do you get a lower bond? Well, there's two options. One option is, a lot of jurisdictions, what they do is they will have you a lot of times the prosecutors and the defense attorneys will banner back and forth, and the prosecutors sometimes will say, look, if you waive the preliminary hearing, we'll, you know, suggest to the judge the bond be lowered. And usually that happens every day in every jurisdiction and every court. And it happens probably more, well, I know it happens more than actually putting the prelim on. So a lot of times if the client agrees, you can waive the prelim, and then the judge usually will agree with the prosecutor and lower the bond. Now, I would say make sure if you agree to waive the prelim that the prosecutor is on the same page and that, you know, they are going to recommend the bond be lower. That's a key thing. There's no point in waiving the prelim if the bond's not being lowered, if that's the sticking point. If the sticking point is the defendant wants a lower bond, and the only way to get that is to waive the prelim. You have to make sure that if the prelim's waived, the bond's going to be lowered. How do you do that? Experience helps. You know, most prosecutors are going to be pretty straightforward with if they say they're going to do it, you know, most likely they'll do it. And they're right there, and the judge is right there too, and you can always make your case if that's not the case. But for the most part, prosecutors are going to agree to that, and that's one way of lowering the bond. So one way out for the defendant is, one way out of jail for the defendant is to agree to waive the prelim, bond gets lowered, and they bond out. That's scenario number one. Another scenario is this. The prosecutors decided they don't want to lower the bond. Why would they do that? It's not because anything you did. It's mainly because there might be some prior arrests for the client. They may think the defendant's a flight risk or has some priors that they're concerned about, whatever. They may not, there may not be any reason, but they may not agree to waive to lower the bond. If you waive the prelim, if that's the case, then you would put the prelim on. And you may put the prelim on anyways, but if that's the case, you put the preliminary hearing on. And then after the preliminary hearing, you would ask the judge to lower the bond. If the judge agrees, you know, you accomplished what you set out to. If the judge doesn't, then there's not really a whole lot you can do about it. On the question of when do you waive a prelim, when don't you, here's all I would say about that. It's up to the client. And the client usually wants to get as low bond as possible and get out of jail. If anyone out there has done immigration law, I've done a little bit. A lot of times your immigration cases are really bond hearings, you know? And that's kind of what I was saying earlier when we started talking. The big thing with criminal law is the first initial phase of the arrest, preliminary hearing to detain, preliminary hearing to prosecute, those are going to be kind of similar to a bond-type representation, meaning the client's trying to get out of jail, and you can help them with that. Just what we talked about, getting the bond lowered, or if they bond out on their own, you don't need to help them with that, or putting the prelim on. Here's what I would say about prelims, and every state's different. Some states, preliminary hearings are very common. Other states, they aren't. I don't, you know, everyone's got to decide, you know, everyone has to observe whatever state they're in. But the thing people don't realize is at preliminary hearings, hearsay evidence is allowed, and the state is not compelled to produce any evidence. So basically, at a preliminary hearing, you're in a hearing with law enforcement, and they're saying one thing, and you're saying another, and then the judge is just going to make their decision. Now, I don't want to be cynical, but usually in local municipal court, you have a judge that's been appointed by a mayor that's running on law and order. And usually, or at least where I'm at, the court case is going to be in the police station courthouse with the judge that was appointed by the mayor. And you're putting on a preliminary hearing where hearsay evidence is allowed and the state isn't compelled to produce any evidence. Okay, so the odds of winning usually aren't great. I'm not saying they can't be won, but the odds aren't great. Most of the time you put a preliminary hearing on, the judge will usually find probable cause to prosecute, meaning keep them there until something happens with the case, till they bond out, etc. The main reason to put one on, though, is again to either get the bond lowered or try to gain some knowledge that you have for the case down the road. Again, they don't, the state or the city prosecutor is not going to put on every law enforcement, especially like in a grand larceny, probably put the arresting officer on and they would testify to, you know, the defendant was seen driving the tractor that was stolen or whatever scenario. And that's all they have to say. They don't have to say, hey, we have the tractor, we have video, we have dash cam, I have a witness, I have a statement. That none of that, they don't have to say any of that. The hearsay evidence is allowed. So normally the judge is going to find probable cause. It's an uphill battle is what I'm getting at. I'm not saying that it's unwinnable. I'm just saying that most likely it's tough for the defendant to win a preliminary hearing in a lot of jurisdictions. Now, let's say that you put the preliminary hearing on and you win. The judge says, you know what, I don't see probable cause here. I'm going to ROR your client. What does ROR mean? Released on own recognizance. So you put the prelim on and you won. You did a great job and you won. Great. End of case, right? No, wrong. All that means is the judge at that level, at the preliminary hearing, did not find probable cause and has decided to let the client walk out without having to post bond. If that happens, number one, congratulations, you're a heck of an attorney. Number two, you must tell your client this does not mean this case is over. Just the fact that you win a preliminary hearing, or just the fact it's dismissed, or the cops drop the case, or whatever happens at that level, does not mean that that case won't go to grand jury. There's been many cases where, for whatever reason, cases were dropped at that level, someone bonded out or left without having to bond out or won a prelim. The case goes to the DA's office. The DA decides to send it to the grand jury and it gets indicted. So you have to let your client know that just because we've won this battle doesn't mean everything's over. And that's very important because you do not want them thinking after you won a prelim or after they're let out on a preliminary decision by the judge that this case is over, because it may not be over, and they need to know that. So that's the main three parts of the preliminary hearing to prosecute. In review, you can waive it with an agreement with the prosecutor. Of course, the client signs off on that. The client says, yes, I want the bond lowered, waive it to get my bond lowered. If the prosecutor agrees, then you can waive it, have the bond lowered. That's one. Two, if the prosecutor decides not to lower the bond and the client wants the bond lowered and there's no chance it's getting lowered, you can put it on to try to win it or to get the bond lowered after you put the hearing on. You could ask the judge, you know, we just had this hearing. I know you ruled against this, but would you consider lowering the bond? He or she may or may not. Or three, put the prelim on and win it. And if you win it, the great thing is you did a great job as an attorney. The caveat I would give, though, is that the case is not necessarily over, and the client needs to know that. So those are the three main parts of the preliminary hearing to prosecute. A couple things, too, that are important for the attorney to know. A lot of times when you get a call and the family or the client says, hey, I just want to bond out. We had the initial appearance, and the bond was set, and I waived my...
Esquire CLE's first verification code is CUP, C-U-P, CUP. Esquire CLE's first verification code is CUP, C-U-P, CUP. Please take a moment and write this down.
preliminary hearing with the public defender already, and they lowered the bond to $10,000. But they're telling me, Mr. Rosa, that I can't bond out, and I just retained you. What do I do? Well, that's where you need to find out why they can't bond out. So here's a few questions you need to ask yourself when you get the call from the defendant. Does the defendant have any priors? And I'm going to go over, and this is what we call holds. Okay, these are holds as why someone couldn't bond out. You have to ask yourself, what are the reasons that they're not being able to bond out, and what are those reasons? The first thing would be a hold. That hold would be maybe old fines. Okay, they may owe $1,000 in misdemeanor fines they never paid. Well, they're not going to let them bond out usually. If they have old fines. Now, that has changed a little bit over the past few years, but in my areas of practice, sometimes they put a hold on, and you can try to get those holds removed if the client wants to bond out, but they have holds. You can make a motion to remove the holds and to reinstate the bond, or reinstate the eligibility for bond. Now, the only thing I would say to that is if someone doesn't have money to pay old fines, I don't see how they're going to be able to pay a bond. But you could do that. But that could be a factor in why someone can't bond out is old fines, old holds. Another factor could be prior charges. And not just, I'm sorry, prior convictions. And you can't hold someone for having a prior charge or prior conviction, but you can if they're on probation. So if a client is on probation for something and they get picked up, they're not going to be able to bond out. That's going to be a probation question or a parole question. So that would be a factor in someone not being able to bond out. So the main thing is going to be old fines or whether or not they're on probation. Now, I always ask the client or the family the client is trying to retain, they always say, you know, do they have any prior charges, any prior convictions? And what I'm trying to get a sense of is whether or not there could be a possibility of probation. Because I know if they're on probation, then there's no chance they're going to be able to bond out until they go in front of the judge for the probation hearing. So those are a couple things that may keep them in jail and not be able to bond out. So let's say you have a client there that is, so in review, this client was arrested, had their initial appearance, had a bond set, had a prelim, bond was lowered, and they're sitting in jail, and three things are going to happen. They're going to bond out, or they don't have the money to bond out, or they are waiting a probation hearing. So we're going to go both. I'm going to talk both as a defendant that's out on bond and a defendant that's still in jail. But a couple things I want to cover before I get into that is on the outline I wrote, the truth about all felony cases, not all felony cases are equal. Find your comfort zone. What do I mean by that? Well, a couple things we're talking about right now. I'm talking about a case where someone gets arrested, it's a grand larceny case. Grand larceny is usually a property or paper theft crime, nonviolent, pretty basic, okay? When I say find your comfort zone, what I mean by that is, as an attorney, if you're going to do felony cases, you have to understand what you're comfortable with. And basically, I always tell people, felonies break down into two areas, violent and nonviolent. Okay, now I'm a criminal defense attorney. And I'm a true believer, so I will defend any charge. I was a public defender for 4 years. It's what I do. It's my career. So any charge I'll do. Obviously, if there's some personal conflict, I won't do it. You know, a family member is involved or something like that. But any charge I will do, violent or nonviolent. Most attorneys aren't comfortable with that. They don't want to do all felony charges, and that's fine. But if you're going to do them, you need to figure out what you're going to do. A lot of nonviolent crimes would be, you know, uttering forgery, credit card fraud, grand larceny. There's a area, and there's a lot of law in that, and a lot of clients that need attorneys on that that may call you. And if that's what you're coming, just do it. Then the other thing would be violent, and that would be, you know, armed robbery, et cetera. And some attorneys don't want to do that, and that's fine too. But you have to decide what, you have to figure it out for yourself. What are you comfortable with? And once you find that comfort zone and know what kind of felonies you're willing to do, then, you know, specify that and practice in that area. Embezzlement, a lot of business felonies are always looking for attorneys, and they're usually looking for attorneys for some reason that have civil experience. I've always found that interesting, but I think it's probably because they know about those attorneys in their business role, so they try to retain attorneys that have civil practice. But it's definitely something to look at: embezzlement, credit card fraud, that sort of thing, if you're uncomfortable with doing the violent charges. But either way, there's a lot of work out there. You just have to, like I said, find your comfort zone and figure it out for yourself. So your clients called you, is trying to make an agreement for you to represent them. Where do you go from there? What I would say is obviously get it in writing. A lot of times what happens is the client calls the lawyer, and the lawyer talks about, okay, well, I'll represent you on this case, and I'm in jail for grand larceny, fine, I'll pay your retainer, fine. And then what happens is there's nothing in writing, and the client that I talked about has got a probation hearing and has an old charge, or has an old charge that's been indicted, hasn't been resolved yet. So they may have, not the probation, but they may have a new charge that they don't know about or you don't know about, plus the charge they're calling you on. You have to get it in writing what you're representing them on. And you have to make sure that it's only one charge, if that's what you're retained on. If the defendant calls you on the grand larceny, you have to get it in writing that you are representing them on the grand larceny only. Because like I said, if something else comes up, they may think they're retained, and you're thinking, geez, I don't even know about that. So it's got to be clear. As far as retainers and hourly, you know, that's going to be up to you. A lot of criminal cases are done just with retainers, but everyone's got their own way. It doesn't really matter. It's up to the attorneys. It's got to be, you know, reasonable. And then also in the writing, what does a representation entail? Make sure in that writing, if you're only representing the client on the grand larceny case, make sure in that writing that that's what it says. And it says nothing about representing the client on the probation case or the newly indicted charge, unless you want to, you know. But it has to be spelled out. What am I being paid for? What am I representing the client on? And then go from there. But most attorneys know how that works, but it's really important. It's really important to do that with the client on a criminal case. Because like I said, there's always things popping up that you may or may not know about. Get it in writing and get the price in writing. And, you know, once the, and it's important because also you have to understand that if it ends in trial, plea, or being passed, that's usually where the representation ends. But there, you know, there is also an appeal process that client may expect you to do. Well, that's a whole different game. You have to get that in writing, and you have to be retained on that, or you can get retained on everything. You can write in something in the, you know, contract in case this goes to trial and we lose, I'll represent the client on, you know, whatever. You can figure it out, but definitely get in writing what the representation entails and the money involved. So the client's in jail, can't bond out, or won't bond out, or has bonded out, doesn't really matter. The next step is you have been retained. You got something in writing, you got what the representation entails, and now you are officially the attorney for this defendant. Okay, what's the next step? The next step would be you have to make a notice of appearance. Okay? The notice of appearance is basically just like any appearance motion. This notice of appearance, you're now the attorney for this person. What I would say is this, is if you're in the initial phase the Wild West arrest phase, where the client's arrested, got a bond set, but has not had a prelim, you may want to file a notice of appearance with that local municipal court or that local county court, only because that will get the defendant's case moving quickly on the prelim or on the bond lowering. If they know that there's an attorney involved, they're going to do everything they can to get that defendant prelim set. So I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not saying that it wouldn't it'd be slower if you did it, but you want to make sure that the court knows that you're the attorney so you can get in right there and get the bond lower or whatever you got to do at that phase. If you're retained, then you would do that notice of appearance to the local, you know, call the court administrator, the municipal judge, and send something over, or the county judge, send something over, and go from there. If the client if that phase is over, and now you're just waiting for indictment, you would, but you were retained, you're going to send that notice of appearance to the whatever the felony court in your state or jurisdiction is. Where I'm at, it's called the circuit court. So I get retained, someone's out on bond or sitting in jail because they can't bond out, but they haven't been indicted yet. I will do a notice of appearance to the circuit, the felony court in our area, the circuit court. Notice of appearance, I represent so-and-so on so-and-so charge. There you go. So now you've noticed the court. Any news with that case, you let the DA's office know you represent them, and then you go from there. But it's important to do that once you get retained, because at that point, you know, you'll be contacted once the DA has their discovery to get to you after an indictment. You know, they know to go to you and not the public defender's office. So it's important to do that. But you would do that as soon as you're retained. But make sure that you are retained where you feel comfortable that you're retained. I'm not telling anybody what to do, but it's good to get whatever the deal is up front before you do a notice of appearance. And once you get the notice of appearance, by all means, I'm sorry, once you get the retainer, by all means, make the notice of appearance. Now, on the outline, number 10 is the same as number 4, and it's redundant for a reason. That's the question, and it coincides with the notice of appearance. So the preliminary hearing to detain or initial appearance already taken place. That was to go in line with the notice of appearance. You would do a notice of appearance to the local court, like I said earlier, or just recently, if there hasn't been a prelim and you're trying to get that moved, and you would do it with the circuit court if the preliminary hearing to detain, the preliminary hearing to prosecute has already taken place. So basically that's just where to set the notice of appearance after you've been retained, or send the notice of appearance after you've been retained. If the, like I said, the prelim's taking place, just send it to the felony court. So the bond was set at 20, it was lowered to 10, and now what? Okay, now what is this? If the client bonds out or is eligible for bond, their responsibility is the following. They have to, and every jurisdiction is different, but the deal that they make when they bond out is, I have to check in. There may be a monthly sign-in. There may be something with the bondsman in the court. I don't know how your jurisdiction works. My jurisdiction is there's a monthly sign-in. Okay, so the person out on bond, their responsibility while they're out on bond is to sign in with the court once a month. And all that is just to let them know they're not a flight risk. I'm around. I bonded out. I'm here. Once you do your notice of appearance and the court knows that you're in the lawyer of record, you know, if your client doesn't show up for a few months to sign in, they may call you. But one thing that I would, you know, encourage all clients to do is, hey, you know, sign in, do it. I mean, it's 20 minutes out of your month. So that's an important thing. And that's what they would have to do. Their responsibility is going to be, if they're out on bond, sign in with whatever program works in your state or jurisdiction and stay out of trouble. That's the other thing. But, you know, that's you have no control over that. The other question would be, so they that's for someone that bonds out. What if someone can't bond out? What if someone can't bond out because of priors or, I'm sorry, because of parole or or whatever reason, now what? Well, they're in jail, and they're going to sit in jail, and they're going to sit in jail until the case is disposed of, or in case their probation is disposed of, or whatever. So what you have to do as an attorney is you have to figure out how long this is going to take. And before I get to that, I do want to say, as far as jail visitations that I wrote on the outline, can I see the defendant at any time 24/7? The question is absolutely yes. You have a right to see your client at any time. Okay, if it's 3 a.m, you have a right to do that, and you'll get it. They may not like it at the jail, but you have that right. So if you have someone locked up in the county jail and you get a call at 2 a.m. and they're saying, "Hey, you got to go see him now. We'll retain him," and you go, then you will get in. There's no question about that. Now, if your client, if you get a call from someone in a state penitentiary, which wouldn't be an arrest that just happened, that would be someone that might want to file a motion of a PCR, post-conviction relief, or has a new charge they just found about that they want you to handle at home, but they want to talk to you in person, I would give one little piece of advice on that. If you have to visit someone in the penitentiary, I would call ahead. And the reason I say that is it's just run totally different than local jail. There's a lot of times I would call ahead. Usually they'll work something out. They'll get you in that day, but you should definitely call ahead and find out what that penitentiary's protocol is, because it may not be, you know, real smooth. You don't want to drive somewhere 2 hours and then, you know, you have to wait around. And if you call ahead, you'll find out what their procedure is, and it can save you a lot of time. And like I said, the only way you get a call from someone in prison would be if they want you to represent them on a post-conviction relief, which is an appellate type motion, or they may have a new indictment that they didn't know about and they want you to handle. So that'd be the only reason for that. Mostly you're going to be dealing with local jails, but yes, you have an absolute right to go see them 24/7 whenever you want. And if it's a problem, then you can make it more of a problem for the jail if they wouldn't let you in. So you go talk to the client. They can't bond out. Like I said, what's their status? Are there holds, their old fines, or that community service, or that probation? Why can't they bond out? Maybe they don't have the money to bond out, which, you know, I don't know how they retained you, but that's a possibility, but they can't bond out. The key then is, like I said, to know, well, how long is this going to take? And if you're the attorney of record, one thing you can do is you can let the DA's office know, "I represent so-and-so, and, you know, well, how long is this going to take to go to grand jury, or what are we doing here?" And if you want, I mean, that's going to be up to your discretion, but, you know, they could sit there a bit if they can't bond out for reasons that you can't control, and that's just something to consider. One thing I didn't want to mention separately is getting a police report, what to look for in a police report. Now, at the preliminary hearing, you need a police report. That's what's going to be determined on whether or not you can. That's going to be what the preliminary hearing is going to be based on, is the police report. So you'll get a copy of that at the preliminary hearing. But if you're retained after the preliminary hearing, then one thing I would do is you're retained and you've done your notice of appearance, then you call law enforcement and you say, "Look, I need a copy of the police report." And, you know, they might work with you. It might be easy. It might not be. And then if it's not easy, then you call the city prosecutor or the DA, or, you know, most jurisdictions, you're not going to have to file a motion to get a police report, but you might. It just depends on who you're dealing with. And it's not always easy, and it's not always a cakewalk, and it's not always fast. But you have to get that police report, you know, and like I said, you'll get it at the prelim, but if you're retained after the prelim, you can get it on your own. The big thing with the prelim, or I'm sorry, with the police report is, it's search and seizure. It's Fourth Amendment. I mean, it's the basis of our whole society. It's what separates us from banana republic and totalitarian governments. I mean, it's our bread and butter in this country. It's search and seizure, probable cause. Did law enforcement have probable cause? And that's what you're looking for in a police report. If there's a warrant, and we're going back to law school here for a lot of people, but if it's a warrant, you know, it's pretty basic what you're going to look for. Was a warrant proper, based on probable cause, precise on its face, issued and signed by a detached neutral magistrate, or was the agent of the government relying on good faith, properly executed? Was it executed without unreasonable delay? Person or place searched and seized within scope of warrant. You know, it's just a general warrant. And I mean, most of the time, it's, you know, you won't find a deficiency on a warrant. They have to go in front, the law enforcement has to go in front of a judge and get it signed. But you need to look for that stuff. Because if you find that those aren't in line, then you have an exclusionary rule argument. So, but that'd be the first thing. If it's a warrant, look for those things. Again, it's like going back to law school and remembering it, but that's what, you know, that's what a warrant must have in it. If there was no warrant involved, which honestly most arrests that I've dealt with are warrantless arrests, you know, it's the old warrantless search exception. Was it incident to a lawful arrest? Was there an automobile search? Was consent given? You know, if no consent was given, you know, how was that handled? You know, I will say this about car searches. If law enforcement wants in the car, yeah, they're going to get in the car. And the way they do it is if it's either consent or if no consent's given, fine, there's a booking, and then they'll do an administrative search. There's absolutely hardly any privacy for anyone in their vehicle, in my opinion. So I always tell clients, you know, just don't think that you have a lot of a right to privacy in the car. I mean, the no consent administrative search is, you know, it's alive and well and used. So that's one thing to look for. Was the incident within the warrantless search exception, was it plain view? Was it consent? You know, the defendant give the law enforcement agent consent to search the house or whatever, even though there was no warrant. They might have been responding to somebody, you know, gave consent to search a house. They found, I mean, so these are all warrantless search exceptions that you have to look at in the police report. And it's important because all you're looking for in a police report is a counter argument to their probable cause argument. Okay, so they have to have a reason for arresting your client. Okay, and that reason has to be based on probable cause. Now, if there's a warrant, was a warrant deficient? If there wasn't a warrant, did they follow these warrantless search exceptions? One, I do want to talk about stop and frisk. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I do think it's important now in light of kind of the changes in some of the big cities. You know, understand the city and state you practice in. That's important here. I don't know if a defendant was arrested in, say, New York City, where they pretty much eliminated stop and frisk. I don't know if, I mean, I know as an attorney, I would say, hey, you got that, you know, that probable cause should be thrown out. That there's no probable cause here. You use stop and frisk, and it's your procedure not to use stop and frisk. Constitutionally, I would lose, but, you know, it's something to consider. I we're on that. I'm never going to have to worry about that, but where you're at, that may be something to consider, to use as a argument for probable cause, a violation when the law enforcement has made an arrest. Like I said, I think city, state, that you practice is important. The other warrantless search exception would be hot pursuit. The law enforcement's chasing someone and, you know, they arrest them and there's some contraband or something pursuant to that hot pursuit that would be allowed in. But those are things to look at in the police report. And again, it's the most important part you can find is you're looking for a violation of, you're wanting to use the exclusionary rule. You know, you're wanting to find something to exclude. And usually the way you find something to exclude is law enforcement didn't do what they were supposed to do regarding, you know, usually it's something they didn't do within the warrantless search exception. You need to look at that and consider it and use it at the prelim, if you're using the prelim or wherever else, negotiate with the DA's office or, you know, try to get it thrown out or whatever. But it's so important. You got to look for probable cause problems for law enforcement. And I would say this, you know, most law enforcement agents, they do their best and, you know, try. They don't have a whole lot of time to, like, type the world's greatest police report. So a lot of times it's going to be pretty vague anyways. And especially if the arrest took place, you know, within the last day or two, and you're having to, and you're going to have the prelim in 2 or 3 days, you know, so there's a chance there to really find some holes in the probable cause argument. That won't be the case if it gets indicted and, you know, you get the discovery. It'll be a lot more detailed by then, but the initial, it'll be more detailed with the whole case being put together, but the initial police report's always going to be the same, and you definitely have to keep your antenna up for some probable cause issues. So we covered D and E, so I want to talk about three, the extended stay with no indictment. What is a habeas corpus motion, process to file habeas corpus motion. The big thing with the habeas motion is you have the option to bring someone in front of the judge that's been sitting in jail to make sure that that party's imprisonment or detention is not illegal. So the answer to my question is you're going to have to figure it out for yourself in the jurisdiction you work at, okay? So if someone's sitting in jail on a murder charge for 4 months and nothing's happened on their case, should I file a habeas? I'm not going to tell you not to, but, you know, that's probably a little, well, I know it's a little bit different than someone sitting in jail, you know, on a credit card fraud for 4 months. So you need to know how your court works. You need to know what your case is. You need to know if the defendant's been sitting there too long, and only you can use that discretion. There is no cookie cutter guidelines I can give you. This is when you file a habeas. It's all going to be discretionary on your part, and it's going to be based on the charge, how long the defendant's been there, you know, a lot of factors. But there are times to do it, you know. When I was a public defender, and I get the public defender, these guys sitting in jail for a long time. And they weren't indicted. And, you know, they were filing crimes, but it was, we're talking a long time. And I had to file some habeases. And basically to get in front of the judge and say, hey, judge, what's, you know, what's the story here? So there are ways to file them. Every one I've filed and I've contacted the court administrator of that court, they've always told me the same thing, contact the prosecutor. So I always did because I was dealing with the court. That's up to you, you know. But I would probably recommend doing that, just kind of give the prosecutor a heads up, hey, you know, so-and-so's been in jail a year or whatever, and, you know, they haven't had anything on their case. They can't, you know, nothing's happening. That one happened with you as an attorney that got the case. Although it could, if it's a serious crime and they can't find out, it could happen to you. But one thing you want to do is you want to let the prosecutor, just give them a heads up. Every court's told me to do that, and I've done it. That's up to you if you don't want to do it. Again, it says use your discretion. But the prosecutor is usually going to say, yeah, that's fine. And basically just call and say, look, I'm going to do a habeas Thursday. You good with that? And usually they'll just say, yeah, you know. And if they say no and you want to still file it Thursday, still file it. But, you know, it's probably a good idea to let the prosecutor know what you want to do or what you plan on doing. Motion for habeas. Who's the defendant? Well, if I got someone sitting in jail and they've been sitting there forever, you know, we have to, at some point, who are the parties in this case? Well, my defendant's the party, right? We're petitioning the court. Well, who are we suing? Put the sheriff's name down. That's who you're going to be suing, and that's who the defendant's going to be. So if the sheriff is, you know, Joe Barker, Sheriff Joe Barker, then it's going to be your client versus Sheriff Joe Barker on a habeas. For illegal detainment, you always put the sheriff down, or whoever's, you know, on head of the jail. If it's a private, I don't know how many local private jails are, but it's whoever's running the jail, and that would be the sheriff in most places, and all definitely always in the county. Obviously, the city jail would be whoever. I guess the police chief would be the person to put on there. But yeah, so that would do, and then you set the hearing in the felony court in your jurisdiction. Now you can also do the hearing at a lower court like county, like in our case, if we file a habeas, we do it in the circuit, which is the felony court, but I can also do it in the county court, which is where it's a county issue. It's the county jail. You can choose which one you want to do, but I always do it in the felony court because I want the judge to know, you know, hey, this case is going to be in front of you at some point, and here's the deal. You know, this guy's been sitting here for X amount of time. But again, that shouldn't be too much of an issue for you if you're getting into the case. Really, that's usually an issue if, you know, you pick up. Now, you could pick up a case. Somebody might have had another attorney or a non or a public defender or something, and nothing's happened. They retain you, and you may have to file it. So, yeah, that's another scenario I didn't even think about. So you may have to file that. That's the way you would do it. When's it appropriate? It's appropriate when it's appropriate, you know? I mean, only you can figure that out. I would not recommend filing a habeas corpus motion in the felony court on a credit card fraud case 20 months after the arrest, but, you know, if that's what you want to do, by all means. But, you know, you're going to have to use your discretion and decide what's the best time for that. But that's how you would do it. You would contact the prosecutor, you're suing the sheriff, you're sitting in your felony court, and you're having at it, and you're basically just letting the judge know what's going on, and then the judge will decide what's going on. We covered what's the defendant's responsibility. Well, out on bond, the defendant's responsibility is to follow the rules of jurisdiction you're in. It could be sign in or contact the bonds company and stay out of trouble if possible. That's always a good thing to do. But that's the main thing, is contact the court or whoever's running the bond, checking on bond. So the next phase is you have the arrest, after the arrest, the prelims, everything. Your client's either out on bond or they're not out on bond. Nothing's happening with the case. And then the case goes to grand jury. Okay, we call that grand jury presentment. Okay, so what will happen is the DA's office at some point will get the file on your client, and they'll decide whether or not to go forward with it. And most times, the DA is going to just give it to the grand jury, see what the grand jury says, you know. So more than likely, that case will go to the grand jury. And what is a grand jury presentment? Well, it's not a great process for us. There's no judge, no defense attorney, just prosecutors and grand jury jurors. Now, everyone's heard the cliche, the platitude, you can indict a ham sandwich. Pretty much true in my experience. I've read stats of 92-93% grand jury indictments that were presented in some states. I can say from my experience that seems about right. So, you know, that's why I said in one of the sections of the outline, you know, no bill, don't plan on it. And a no bill is the case is presented to the grand jury and the grand jury no bills it, meaning the grand jury says there's not enough evidence for probable cause, we're not going to indict. Now, one thing I would say quickly, most likely that's probably the end of it. However, it doesn't mean it has to be the end of it. Just like the attorney that won the prelim for the defendant at the preliminary hearing to prosecute, and the judge ROR's, and as we talked about earlier, doesn't mean that client won't be indicted. Just because a case was no-billed at grand jury doesn't mean they won't come back and try to indict. So there's no double jeopardy with this. So just because it's no-billed, I mean, it's a good sign. In most cases I've dealt with, it's usually the end of it. But a prosecutor can send it back to grand jury if they want. So you have to be aware of that. But they're so rare, you need to prepare for the worst anyway. So that's what I was saying in the under the no bill. I'd say no, prepare for the worst. But going back to the grand jury presentment, you have no judge, no defense attorney. They're going to put their case on. It's a probable cause standard. It's a very low bar, you know. There's no one there to combat anything the prosecutor's saying. They've known these jurors for 3-4 months. you know, they got a rapport with them, it's a good chance this case is going to get indicted, you know? So again, it's probable cause. Now they need evidence, but by that time there's usually, you know, the case is pretty much worked out. So if they take it to grand jury, they're planning on it getting indicted, they being the DA's office. And I can say by experience, if it goes to grand jury, I get indicted. Again, no bill finding means no indictment for now. We covered that. What is an indictment? It's formal criminal charges by the government. So you're indicted. Now the government's charged you. The only thing that counters the grand jury that I want to cover briefly is criminal information. Some states have criminal information, but most states have grand jury presentment. Okay, my state's grand jury presentment. I think Arkansas either used to or still does use a criminal information. Basically, a criminal information is a formal criminal charge made by a prosecutor without grand jury indictment. You know, both ways as a criminal defense attorney, I'm not a fan of the grand jury system. But I don't know how much of a fan I'd be of the prosecutor making decisions. So, you know, either way, to me, it's not great, but I'm biased. But some states do have criminal information. I have no idea how you would deal with that. I guess you would get more involved with the prosecutor. But those are, like I said, I know Arkansas did it or did them. I don't know if they still do or not. But plan on being assistant with the grand jury. And then once you're indicted, or not you, but once your client's indicted, because odds are that they will, then the next phase of, or the next step in criminal procedure after the indictment is a right to counsel issue, which your client will get whether or not you represent them, right? So the first right to counsel issue that the client is guaranteed, whether you're the attorney or not, is preliminary.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is BOWL. B-O-W-L, BOWL. Esquire CLE's second verification code is BOWL, B-O-W-L. Please take a moment and write this down.
You're hearing to prosecute. Okay, the right to counsel there. The next right to counsel is arraignment. You're indicted. Your client's indicted. Now what? Okay, now it's an arraignment. So what's an arraignment? Arraignment's either enter a plea, guilty or not guilty. Well, you're never going to say, always going to plead not guilty. Okay, I mean, I know that's obvious, but, you know, at the arraignment, you always plead not guilty. And I, like I said, I know I'm overstating the obvious, but it's good to know. How does the arraignment procedure work? Well, courts are going to do it differently. Usually, in our circuit and in most courts, the court really, with the size of the dockets, it'd be really hard pressed to do in-person arraignments on everything. Now, some courts do, but some courts like ours, they use waiver of arraignments for nonviolent crimes. If it's a violent crime like an armed robbery or a murder or a sexual battery case, a violent crime like that, that's going to be an in-person arraignment, okay? You're going to get your client in front of the judge, and they're going to read the charges, and then you're going to plead not guilty, and then you're going to sign that waiver of arraignment in front of the judge. Prosecutor's going to sign it. The judge is going to set a trial date. Now, if it's a nonviolent crime, you can bypass a lot of times that step with the judge. The hearing with the judge, you can just basically do the waiver of arraignment and be done with it. Now, I will say this quickly: if someone's been indicted, like say there's a capias, and what a capias is someone may have been indicted in the past and just quit going to sign it, or it might have been a, you know, some little low-level possession charge or something, and so basically a defendant's got a capias without them knowing. And that happens a lot. Like, there might be an indictment that someone that might have had some issues in the past with the legal system that didn't know about or didn't get dropped. If that person gets picked up, say they're pulled over and the law enforcement runs their record and they see that there's an indictment capias, they'll take them in. The only way that person can bond out is to sign the waiver of arraignment. So they got an indictment. They're picked up on a capious indictment. They're in jail, and they're sitting there. They just can't bond out. There is no bond. The bond is what the bond was originally set. Could have been years ago. So what you have to do as an attorney, if you're in that situation, is you have to get a waiver of arraignment, cheat, and get the client to plead not guilty. You sign it, get it to the prosecutor. You guys agree on bond, and the judge signs it, puts it in the system, then they can bond out. But they cannot bond out on a capious indictment unless the waiver of arraignment is done. So they have to have a, they need a trial date. So that's basically what it is. And that's basically the point of the arraignment, is to plead not guilty and set a trial date. So that's the main thing to know about that. Again, the more violent crimes, will be an in-person arraignment. And then the less violent, you know, you may have an option to do just a waiver. But that is a right to counsel. You know, there is a right to counsel for the defendant to have an attorney present at the arraignment proceeding. So that's something to know, and it's something to ready to go on. After the arraignment and the trial date set, you know, it's a big question. Now what? Now what do I do? How it usually works is at some point, you know, I don't know, every court's different. Our court usually is going to set, we have literally the rocket docket where I work, so the court will set the trial quickly, 60 days, you know, 90, whatever it is, 90 days. Now, of course, we can get continuances if it's definitely going, but it's going to be quick. Usually in that time, what happens is the DA's office will send over a offer, okay? They're going to send a offer of, if so-and-so pleads guilty to the grand larceny charge, we're going to recommend community service or something like that. Now, they're always going to do that. If the case is indicted and there's a trial date, the DA's office is usually going to send over an offer. They don't have to send over an offer, but usually they do, okay? And you got to take the offer, and then you got to decide where the case goes, you know, and then you need to talk to the DA. I mean, if it's a weak case, you know, you may be able to convince the district attorney's office, look, man, there's nothing here, you know, let's get this thing dropped, and, you know, can you pass it, can you do this, and, you know, that's all part of negotiations. And the other thing is, the DA's office, the prosecutor does not have to make an offer, okay, then there's like this urban myth that they have to make three offers. They don't have to make any offers. So understand that whatever offer they send over, it's just that. It's just an offer. And then where you take it from there is up to you as an attorney. But that's just part of plea negotiations. You know, you're either, if you think that you can, if you think that by explaining to them and going over the evidence with them, you think it's a bad, you know, I mean, I've had many cases dropped after cases were indicted, just sitting down with ADAs and district attorneys, look, there's nothing, you know, this is a bad case. But doesn't happen a lot, but it happens. So you might be able to get the case dropped. That's always your goal first, you know. I mean, hopefully, just get it passed or find a reason, find a motion that you can get it to go away for your client, right? There might have been a probable cause issue that we talked about. There might be some other issues. So that's the first thing you're looking at is, how do I get this thing passed or dropped? Now, if that doesn't happen, then, you know, the plea negotiations take place. And, you know, just like we learned in law school, you're get the best deal for your client. That's what you're trying to do. You're trying to get the absolute best deal for your client. And the client at some point is either going to decide, you know, they're either going to want to plea out, or they're going to want to go to trial. So those are the only two options. And, you know, ultimately they have to make that decision. And it's your job to get the best plea offer possible. And then if it goes to trial, to prepare for trial. But, you know, once the case is indicted and once the defendant's put his arraignment, his or her arraignment, had their arraignment hearing and pled not guilty and a trial date was set, then it's up to you to get with the DA after they send an offer. Or you can be aggressive and go over there before an offer and just get with them. It doesn't hurt. It never hurts to talk to the district attorney's office when you're negotiating a plea. You know, I always tell everybody, you know, unless it's definitely going to trial, you know, it doesn't hurt you to communicate. In fact, I would recommend it. Communicate, you know. If it's going to trial, it doesn't matter. But, you know, you can always never quit negotiating for your client. Get the best deal you can, and they make the determination what they want to do. Now, there are such things as an open plea. On the outline, I said caveats. Do I use sometimes? I have used them sometimes, but I've used them in certain situations. So what's an open plea? An open plea is your client pleads guilty to the charge that the indictment brought forth and the DA is charging them with, but we'll let the judge determine the sentence. Now, I wrote caveat down there for a reason. Be aware of that. And here was my situation when I did it. I was a public defender. I was in the judge's court for 4 years every day. If not every day, close to every day. I knew how the judge was. I knew how the cases were going to go. I knew when the DA's office, in my opinion, was being a little overreaching or being a little harsh. And I usually knew how the judge thought on things. Okay, I've done that before. And in all cases that I pled someone up, which wasn't very often, we're talking two or three times and talking, you know, 21, 22-year-olds. So, you know, I kind of knew where the judge was. It always worked in my favor, okay? But I would beware of that because, you know, you don't know if you don't know how the judge is, then it's going to be very difficult to do an open plea. You have to know how the judge thinks and where the judge would go. So, like I said, they're always an option. Beware of it. Now, here's the other thing. If on an open plea, this happened to someone I know, say your client's a habitual offender, okay? Now, in the state of Mississippi, a habitual offender is two felonies and you're habitual, okay? So if you have two felonies, you're automatically habitual. If you get a third felony, if it's a violent crime, they can try and get life on you, they being a DA's office. If it's a nonviolent crime, they can get day for day, okay? So if you're arrested for grand larceny, which carries 10, and you've got two priors, guess what? If it goes to trial, they could get 10 day for day. So habitual, it's a big deal. If you go into a plea negotiation with a DA and you have a habitual offender, one of the things you want to negotiate is, okay, we're going to plead to grand larceny, drop the habitual, and they'll do it, okay? They will do it. You know, you can't plead to the max, and you can't plead, but they will do that, you know. For purpose of plea, we're going to drop the habitual. In most cases, some they won't, but if something's been worked out, they'll drop it. There was an attorney that had he was negotiating the DA's office. He had a habitual offender, and the deal was something to the effect of drop the habitual, plead guilty to, you know, 8 years to serve, let's say. Well, the defense attorney thought the 8 years was outrageous, okay, because they thought it was just too much time for the crime or whatever. So the DA or the criminal defense attorney said, fine, I'm just going to do an open plea. And the DA's office said, well, that's fine, but we're not dropping the habitual, meaning you can do an open plea with a habitual offender, but the DA's office still has to agree to drop the habitual off the habitual offender. And let me tell you something. If you can't work it out with them and it's going to an open plea, it's probably not a good idea to think that you're going to get them to drop it on an open plea, although they may. But that's just something to think about. If you're going to do an open plea with a habitual offender, the DA's office must agree to drop in the habitual. The judge can't do it. I mean, the DA's, because they're the ones bringing the charges, so they have to agree to drop the habitual. That's a very important thing to consider. But again, as far as open pleas, I would say, you know, beware. I mean, you can use them, but just know where you're at. Trial, you know, prep, you need to look at local rules and rules of evidence, right? If this thing can't get worked out, this case you have can't get worked out, and it's going to trial, then, you know, you need to put a trial on it. You know, I would say, if you haven't done a felony trial before, I would definitely probably associate with somebody that's got experience doing trials. But, you know, I mean, all trials aren't, you know, like all felony crimes aren't created the same. All trials aren't created the same either. I mean, you know, a possession charge with, you know, one law enforcement agent, if that would somehow go to trial, which normally you can avoid trial on those, but you know that there's not going to be the paperwork or the amount of witnesses as say a murder case, obviously. So you know you just have to realize what kind of case you got, and but first trial, if you want to associate someone, that's fine, but you know definitely look at the local rules as far as when to file things, and then you know you have to be ready to go on your trial, whatever. You have to know the rules of evidence and be ready to go on that. So that'd be my advice, but definitely look at the local rules first, and if you need to associate. One of the things I wanted to cover, and we're getting close to wrapping up here, but one of the things I wanted to cover was constitutional rights to the defendant, whether I'm hired or not. These are important to know. You know, what are my client's rights? You know, if you're not immersed in criminal law or criminal procedure, you know, it's second nature for me, but you know, if you're not doing it all the time, then it's something you just need to think about or, you know, re-educate yourself on. But just, you need to know these things going into a case. But Fourth Amendment, you know, prohibition against unreasonable search and seizures and the exclusionary rule, we went over that. You know, I'm a fanatic when it comes to unreasonable search and seizure. Like I said, like I pontificated earlier in the talk, you know, it separates us from countries that aren't great. You know, it really does. I mean, you just can't come into someone's house and do what you want to do. You know, you just can't pull someone over. So these are all important factors. And this is really the heart of criminal law, especially at the level that we talked about, the arrest, preliminary hearing phase, and then obviously any pretrial motions. This is the heart of it, you know. And just look for those probable cause issues. The Fifth Amendment, prohibition against compulsory self-incrimination, and prohibition against double jeopardy. Everybody knows what double jeopardy is, although, like I said, that's on a felony trial. That's not on a no-bill indictment, and it's not on a preliminary hearing that you as an attorney did a great job in the one, and they ROR'd your client, okay? There's no double jeopardy attachment to that. Only to a felony, not guilty verdict trial. So important to know, and important for the client to know after you give that great argument, the prelim, and they win, they think the case is over with. The compulsory self-incrimination, you know, one thing I would say about that is you're going to get videos, you're going to get stuff in discovery if you go to trial, and they're always going to say, well, you know, we have videos and this, and you need to really pay attention to that, because a lot of times, a client will be talking and might stop the talk, and then it gets restarted again. You know, there's ways to, you know, and that's not barred, so you need to get up to speed with that. But most of the time, if the client's talking, it's going to be hard to get around. But there are little things you can look at on the video that they provide during discovery to see if he or she said they didn't want to talk anymore, and you need to figure out if you have a Fifth Amendment argument there for pretrial. Sixth Amendment, right to speedy trial, public trial, trial by jury, confront witnesses, compulsory process for obtaining witnesses, assistance of counsel. That's a big one, right? Right to counsel, Sixth Amendment. They're all big, but this, for purposes of our conversation, you know, I think the search and seizure and the right to counsel is really the bread and butter of this talk. But a lot of lawyers don't know what exactly right of counsel entails and what it doesn't. So the assistive counsel, right of counsel, is there a right of counsel for X? Okay, yes. You have right. The defendant has the right of counsel for custodial police interrogation, for post indictment interrogation. So, custodial police interrogation, it goes back to the Fifth, right? Prohibition against self-incrimination, compulsory self-incrimination, prohibition against compulsory self-incrimination, Fifth Amendment, right? That's custodial police interrogation. They're in custody. They've been arrested. They have the right to remain silent. They do not have to talk. They have right to counsel right there. It attaches, okay? Client doesn't want to talk, defendant want to talk, they don't have to talk. Okay, custodial police interrogation, right to counsel, post-indictment interrogation. What's that mean? I haven't seen it, but hey, you know, you never know. But yeah, if someone's indicted and the law enforcement wants to talk to them, you know, about the case or cutting a deal or something, they have a right to an attorney. And you need to know if anyone's contacting them after they've been indicted. Preliminary hearing to determine probable cause to prosecute, we've covered that. Arraignment, answering the indictment, we've covered that. Post-charge lineup, that's after, a lineup's okay before a charge, but after a charge, they can't put the defendant in the lineup. So there's a right to counsel there. You need to know about that. Doesn't happen. Well, I don't know. I mean, it hasn't happened with me a lot, but it could happen. Guilty pleas. Your client pleads guilty, there's a right to counsel. Misdemeanors in some cases. I won't go into those. Felony trial, sentencing, hearings, appeals as a matter of right. Now, I will say, you know, as a public defender, when I was a public defender for 4 years, really, there were. I always look at like the right to counsel. You know, was a preliminary hearing to determine to prosecute, arraignment, plea or trial, sentencing. That was 99% of what we did, because even if someone, if we lost a trial and there was an appeal, then you usually file form of they were indigent and needed an appellate attorney. So that was the bread and butter. You know, it was the prelim, arraignment, plea or trial, sentencing. But, you know, as an attorney, especially if you're representing someone as a private attorney, you know, their right to counsel is whatever you can do for them. You know, it's the bond hearings and that sort of thing. So, you know, there may be, or the other things before trial, that sort of thing. You know, you can make a difference. There may not be a constitutional right to counsel on it, but as an attorney, you know, you got to go beyond that. But that's what the right to counsel is. I think it's important to know what a defendant will get if they don't hire you. And it's, you know, it's a few things. It's not as much as people think. Where there's no right to counsel, it's a pretrial taking of blood samples. If your client consents, it's pulled over for DUI and consents, and there's no right to counsel. Taking of handwriting or voice recording, no right to counsel. The initial appearance, preliminary hearing to determine probable cause, we talked about that. No right to counsel. Photo ID or pre-charge, talked about that. No right to counsel. After trial, discretionary appeals, post-conviction proceedings, no right to counsel. Post-conviction proceeding would be a post-conviction relief that I talked to you about, that you might get a call from someone in the penitentiary wants you to do that, and you know, an appeal. Public defender is not there's no right to counsel, say, for an indigent client to get the public defender to do an appeal. Now, we have an appeals office that does that, but you know, we'll file something and they'll get the case. But public defender or the attorney for the indigent from arrest to disposition of the case, that there's no right to counsel after the case is disposed. And I'm just, again, using the public defender as an example because it's letting you know what exactly is entailed in right to counsel. And then finally, parole and probation revocation. There is no right to counsel on that. And that's why one of the things I said early on, if you get a call and you can do those cases, but there's no right. There would be no right to counsel by an attorney to show up for a probation. Now, if it's not adjudicated, there's an issue there. But most cases aren't non-adjudicated. You know, community service, that sort of thing. A probation hearing, you know, the judge is going to bring them in front, the defendant in front, and have the hearing. And there's no right to counsel. And the judge can revoke just for being, you know, for probable cause. I mean, being in front of them and probable cause is an issue. So there's a, but there is no right to counsel. But it is a area of law, too, that if you're interested in doing it, it's not just felony probation, but misdemeanor probation, too. It's also a an area of law that you could get into within the criminal procedure world. So that wraps up the talk. Hope there wasn't too much there for you, but try to wrap up criminal procedure, and hope any attorneys want to do felony work, hope this helped. I can be reached by email. I'm old school, CTROSE@hotmail.com. Just in the header, say you had heard me giving a continuing legal education talk, and I will get right back to you. Again, Craig Rose, Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And good luck, and have a great day.